I started, or before I start, I wanted to give you a URL. You can see it in Notepad on the screen behind me. I'm going to be showing lots and lots of code samples. If you would like a copy of those samples for yourself, you can go to this URL at your convenience, and you can pull down a zip file. It's about 20 megabytes in length. And you can have all the samples that I'll be showing here, as well as the samples that I'll be showing in other sessions here in Antwerp. So I'll leave Notepad open, and I'll bring it back up at the end of the session. But again, you can go to this URL at your convenience, and you can download a zip file containing all of the samples that I'll be showing. So without further ado, let's get started, because we have a lot to talk about. So you probably know this already, but just in case you didn't catch it, Silverlight 5 was released into beta last week. Microsoft has been talking for a while now, since December, about what the new features are going to be. But they let us get our first look at it, so we can all go to the Silverlight website now. We can download the Silverlight beta, and we can start playing with it. I put this session together because I want to give you a first-hand look at what's coming in Silverlight 5. Now, in the beta, some of the features that are promised in Silverlight 5 aren't there yet. So in addition to going through the features that are there and showing demos around those, at the end of the session, I'm going to talk about the features that aren't there in the beta, but that will be there before the product ships. If you are a Silverlight developer, I think you'll find that there's a lot to like in Silverlight 5. Some of the things that we've been asking for a long time, like real 3D, hardware-accelerated 3D, is finally there in version 5. But there are a lot of other features as well that I want to show to you. So what I'm going to do is bring those to you one by one, starting with some of the more subtle improvements to the runtime, revolving around improvements to the text engine. Now, as you may know, in every version of Silverlight up to now, Microsoft has done things to make text display faster and more crisp. Early versions of Silverlight, for example, didn't support text anti-aliasing. They didn't support OpenType or ClearType. That was added back in Silverlight 3. That was improved in version 4. And they're doing more for us around text in version 5. There will be, in a later build, before the product is released, something that improves the clarity of text, something called pixel snapping. You may have noticed, for example, that depending on where text is positioned on, say, a canvas, it may not look quite the way you want it to, because if it's positioned using fractional pixels, the anti-aliasing can make the text look a little bit less than optimal. Pixel snapping, coming post-beta, is going to fix that for us so that we'll have a great text display no matter where we have that text positioned. There are also some other things like enhanced OpenType support coming post-beta. But there are some things that we can look at right now in the beta. One of those is support for leading or character spacing. In the past, if you were building applications in Silverlight that were very heavy on text display and you needed a very fine degree of control over the character spacing, there really wasn't a good way to get that. You could use glyphs to do it, but it became very, very tedious to make that happen. And if you ever tried it, you know that performance was a problem as well. In Silverlight 5, text elements have a new property named character spacing that makes it very, very easy to control the leading or the spacing between characters. Something else that's new in version 5 with regard to text is linked text boxes. So here's the deal. It won't be long before we're all going to be writing applications for slates, for pads. That seems to be the future. One of the things that's popular back in the U.S. right now is to write reader-type interfaces so that you can read magazines, books, and things like that online. Now, while you can build that kind of interface with Silverlight 4, if you've ever tried it, you know that there are some difficulties. If you wanted, for example, to do a really nice, crisp, multi-column text display, it's very difficult to do that in Silverlight 4, especially if the text is dynamic, if it needs to flow due to changes in character spacing or changes in the size of the text, for example. So in Silverlight 5, they give us the ability to link rich text box controls together, so that when the content that we've placed in the first one is too big to fit inside it, the runtime will automatically flow that text into another text box. Exercising this feature is as simple as it could be, because the rich text box control in Silverlight 5 has a new property named Overflow Content Target. You use a simple binding expression like the one I'm using here to connect this text box to another. And even though I'm only showing this with two text boxes here, you could link as many rich text boxes as you wanted to produce rich multi-column displays. And I will show this in action in just a moment. Remember that character spacing is something we finally have control over in Silverlight 5. As I mentioned earlier, the new elements like text block and rich text box in Silverlight 5 now have a character spacing property. If you set it to something rather high like 100, you can see that the spacing between the characters increases. So let me show you some of this in action here. To do that, I'm going to pop over into Visual Studio and bring up one of those samples that's in the zip file whose URL I showed you a few moments ago. Let's go over into our Silverlight 5 samples. And the one I'm looking for is this one right here, Text Overflow Demo. So when this runs, what you're going to see in the browser is a simple reader-type interface. It's a multi-column interface. It will be a multi-column interface once I get it up and going. And you'll see some textual content on the two halves of the page. Let's see if we can get it booted up here. So what I have here is a little newspaper-style application called the Daily Plugin, very appropriate for Silverlight, I think. And I've put some dummy text inside, and you can see that I've broken it up into two columns. What you're really looking at here is two rich text box controls, one on the left, one on the right. The two of them are linked together via that overflow content target property that I showed you in the slides. And to demonstrate how text flows from one rich text box to another, I've put a pair of sliders down here, one of which is data bound to the font size property of the text in the first text box, the other of which is bound to the character spacing property. In other words, I can use the top slider to increase and decrease the size of the text. I can use the bottom slider to increase and decrease the character spacing. So if I do this, for example, again, this slider is bound to the font size property of the first text box. You can see how the text flows very well from one text box to another. In fact, I can just keep increasing that font size like that. And if I wanted this to be a three-column display, all I'd have to do is declare a third text block, a rich text box control, and use its overflow content property to point it to the third text block, rich text box. Now, I can also vary the character spacing, remember? All I'm doing with this slider is adjusting the character spacing property. You can see how the letting or the spacing between characters grows larger and larger as I move that to the right. If I want the default spacing, I can just slide that all the way to the left here. So again, we're not only seeing how to link these rich text boxes together, but also how nicely and dynamically, if you prefer, the text content flows between them. And of course, since it's a rich text box control, you're not limited to text content. Any content that you place inside this rich text box control will flow from one to the other. Now, let me show you a quick look at the XAML here that makes this happen. And that is right here. Pretty simple stuff, really. To create that two-column display, I declared a couple of rich text boxes. Here we go. Looks like Visual Studio needed just a moment to come alive. There is the one showing the text on the left. And a little bit further down is the rich text box overflow control that shows the text on the right. Now, you can see that on the rich text box here, I've placed content inside it. This is the content that you saw appearing in both of those text boxes. I also set font sizes and a few things like that on that rich text box. But note that in the rich text box overflow control, I didn't have to set any of that because when the content flows from one to the other, any properties that were set on the one, the control that the text is flowing from, are automatically brought over to the rich text box overflow control. Where is the linkage? How are those two connected together? Right here, the overflow content target property, new, remember, in Silverlight 5, points to that rich text box overflow control that's going to contain the overflown text. So that's a quick look at what we're doing with text displays in Silverlight 5. Is it exciting? Well, it really depends on what you're going to do with it. If you're building these reader-type interfaces, you'll find that your job is much, much easier than it was in Silverlight 4. But that's not all that's coming. in Silverlight 5, fortunately. This would be a short talk if that's all that were coming. Another thing I'd like to bring your attention to in Silverlight 5 is the improvements that they're making to the media engine. And there are a couple of things that are really noteworthy there. One is that if you're using sound effects in your applications, I have an application, for example, that has sort of a simulated keyboard that the user can press keys on to do textual entry. I also have some sound effects connected to that. However, pre-Silverlight 5, to make those sound effects work, to play a clicking sound, for example, when the user clicks one of those virtual keys, I had to use a media element to do it. That didn't work out all that well, because media element doesn't guarantee us that there's going to be little or no latency between the time we call play and the time that it actually plays that sound. And if you've ever used media element to do sound effects, you know that there tends to be a delay, sometimes up to a second or so, between the very first call to play and the time that that sound plays. So Silverlight 5 borrows a page from the Silverlight for Windows Phone playbook. It begins to bring some of the capabilities and features from the XNA framework into Silverlight. One of the things you can do with XNA in Silverlight 5 is use the sound effect class. Now, if you're an Xbox game developer, you may have used this class before. If you're a Silverlight for Windows Phone developer, you may have used it before as well. Now, you can use it in Silverlight 5. One other thing that's notable is something called Trick Play, which partially works in the Silverlight 5 beta and partially does not. I'll show you what I mean here in just a moment. Simply put, what Trick Play allows you to do is to vary the playback rate of audio and video content that you're playing through a media element control. So if you've ever wanted, for example, to show a certain sequence of a video in slow motion, you can now do that without resorting to the kinds of hacks we used to use pre-Silverlight 5. In addition, one of the really cool things about Trick Play is something called audio pitch correction. You can imagine that if you're playing video through a media element control and you slow it down to, say, half speed, that's going to distort the sound. The sound is going to sound really warbly and weird, right? Well, with Trick Play, the answer is no. What Microsoft does is, when you have slowed down or sped up the playback of that video, they will take the audio track and play it without changing any pitches. Now, you'll see what I mean in just a moment, at least partially, because the audio pitch correction isn't there in the Silverlight 5 beta. One last thing that's notable with regard to media in Silverlight 5 is that we now have the ability to do GPU decoding of the frames in H.264 videos. If you've ever played H.264 video in Silverlight before, you know that it does it, but it tends to really stress the CPU. By simply slapping a cache mode equals bitmap cache attribute and value onto a media element now, we can get the GPU involved in decoding those HD frames coming down and provide a much better experience for the user, as well as decrease the CPU utilization in our application. Now, the sound effect class, a little piece of XNA brought into Silverlight 5. Again, if you're doing sound effects in your apps, if you have a little click.wav file, for example, that you want to play each time the user clicks in a certain region of the screen, rather than use the media element to do that, the proper way to do that now is to use the XNA sound effect class. See a using statement at the top? I'm simply importing the namespace in which the sound effect class lives. Then I call sound effects static from stream method to download the audio asset. In this case, I'm importing or loading a little audio file named gong.wave and wrapping a sound effect around it. Now, whenever I want to play that sound effect, I simply call play on the sound effect class. Will it sound any different than it would have with media element? No, but Silverlight does guarantee me through the sound effect class that this is low latency audio, so you should not discern any gap, any delay between the time you call play on that sound effect object and the time the sound effect actually plays through the user's speakers. Trick play, remember, is a new feature on the media element control that allows us to do variable rate playback with audio pitch correction. Using it is just about as simple as it can be. The media element in Silverlight 5 has a new property named playback rate. I can set that to 0.5 if I want to do a half-speed slow motion playback, or if I wanted to make it really fast, if I wanted to double the playback rate, for example, I could set that to 2.0. Let me show you a quick demo involving trick play, or at least what parts of trick play are present in the Silverlight 5 beta. So I'm going to open up another project that's in that zip file, his URL I gave you a few minutes ago. And we're going to play a little music here. If you're a guitar player, you may appreciate this. I've played guitar for a long, long time, still not very good at it. In fact, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am, given how long I've been playing. But back in my college days, when I actually did a lot more guitar playing than I did right now, in order to play in local bands, I spent hours and hours and hours sitting down with albums. Remember those? Before CDs? Playing little snippets over and over to try to figure out all the leads that the guitar player was playing. I would have loved to have had a tool like this, something that would let me see what the guitarist's fingers were doing so I could just sort of copy what he's doing. It would be the guitar equivalent of cut and paste. So I put together a little trick play demo here with one of my favorite rock and roll tunes of all time, showing the fingering on the keyboard. So let's see if we can get this to work. In fact, with that little bit right there, can anyone tell me what song this is? Free pass to the conference if you can name this tune. Actually, you don't need a free pass. You're already here, right? Now, in a minute, this guy's going to start really cranking on here, and I want to slow things down to see exactly how he's doing what he's doing. By the way, the song is Voodoo Child, originally by Jimi Hendrix. Okay, let's slow this thing down here. Let's see what his fingers are really doing. So what I've done here is just added a slider control that is data-bound to the playback rate property of the media element. Everything is slowed down to half speed now, so I can look very carefully and see how he's doing what he's doing. Now, you notice that there's no sound, right? Makes it easy to do audio pitch correction when you just shut off the sound. So, the audio pitch correction is not implemented in the beta, but you can take this sample here, and when a later build of Silverlight 5 comes out, you can play it. And what you'll find is that the sound will not turn off, and thanks to audio pitch correction, you'll be able to hear what he's playing without distortion while you have it slowed down or while you have it sped up. So I'll admit, it's a little bit of an anticlimactic demo given that the audio pitch correction isn't there yet, but again, we're just planning for the future. And guess what? If you're a guitar player with this, it's going to make it really easy for you to learn the lead on Voodoo Child. So go back to the slides here for a moment. See what else we can get into with version 5. So here's something that you don't read about a lot yet. In fact, I'm not sure how much you'll read about it at all. But it's something that you should know about because if you're a Silverlight developer, it's something that will probably profoundly impact what you do, although you may not even know that it's impacting you. Specifically, there have been a couple of changes made to Silverlight's internal threading architecture. One of those changes has to do with the networking stack. In Silverlight 4, when you use the networking stack, everything is asynchronous. You already know that. You fire up an HTTP web request, for example. You put a call out on the wire, perhaps to go fetch some data from a REST service, and that call is placed asynchronously. We do that so we can avoid tying up the UI thread and making that UI freeze. When that call completes, a notification comes in. If it's HTTP web request that you use to place the call, that callback or that notification comes on a CLR thread pool thread. If it was web client that you used instead, then the callback comes on the same thread on which the call was originally placed, which is typically the UI thread. However, if you've ever done that in Silverlight, if you've ever used the networking stack, you may have noticed that the calls don't actually get out on the wire at the moment you make them, despite the fact that Silverlight, even in version 4, was using multi-threading internally to make those calls as non-invasive as possible from a UI standpoint. One of the changes they're making to the internal threading architecture is that they're going to get everything off of the UI thread. So when you new up that HTTP web request on the UI thread and you place a call, that call is immediately going to be dispatched onto a CLR thread pool thread so that there's no latency between the time the call actually goes out on the wire and the time you place the call. You may not even notice that, but what Microsoft is telling us is that we can expect up to 90% less latency in certain scenarios. So that's just going to work, and there's nothing you have to do in your code to exercise that. There's another change that has been made to the internal threading architecture that is perhaps more impactful. If you look or think about the threading architecture of Silverlight 4, it really hasn't changed any since Silverlight 2. There is a UI thread, which is actually borrowed from the browser. That's the thread that most of your code executes on. It's the thread that rendering is done on. It's also the thread that animations run on. And if you've ever done something like this in Silverlight, you've started an animation, then you do something on the UI thread that ties that thread up for half a second or a second or 2 seconds or something, you've probably noticed that those animations stop. That's because in Silverlight 4, the vast majority of the work that you do and that the runtime does happens on that UI thread. And it's why we've always told Silverlight developers, whatever you do, avoid hogging that UI thread because Silverlight needs it as well. That changes a bit in Silverlight 5, which introduces a new thread called the composition thread. Now, this isn't completely new. In fact, the idea for the composition thread comes from Silverlight for Windows Phone, which has a composition thread as well. What is the composition thread? It is the thread upon which most GPU-related operations run in Silverlight 5. So here's what that means. If you're running an animation in Silverlight 5, and if the object that's being animated is being animated on the GPU, then we totally remove the work of animating that object from the UI thread. We put it on the composition thread, and now that composition thread can run in the background doing whatever it needs to make that animation run on the GPU. There are actually other uses for the composition thread as well. In fact, I'm going to talk about one of those towards the end of this presentation when we look at the new 3D engine in Silverlight. But first and foremost, the purpose of the composition thread is to allow work involving the GPU that's normally done on the UI thread and is done on the UI thread in Silverlight 4 to be taken completely off the UI thread in Silverlight 5. Now, what is that going to mean? It means that if you use this composition thread, you can make your UI more responsive. You can also guarantee that animations that are running on that GPU don't stop or halt or stutter. If for some reason you have to take a little bit more time than you would like on that UI thread, I'm going to demonstrate that for you in a moment, but first let me show you how you use the composition thread. In this example here, I've declared a rectangle in XAML. And because I've included a cache mode equals bitmap cache attribute, that rectangle is going to be rasterized one time on the UI thread, then hand it off to the GPU so that all further manipulations of that rectangle will be done on the GPU rather than on the CPU. In addition to declaring the rectangle and making sure that it's going to be managed by the GPU, I've also declared a simple transform that I can use to rotate that rectangle and a double animation that I can use to animate the angle property of the rotate transform to make the rectangle spin round and round. Now, this animation in Silverlight 5 is going to run on the GPU. And furthermore, in Silverlight 5, this animation will not use the UI thread at all. It will use the dedicated composition thread. There's literally nothing more or less that I have to do to make that happen than what I've shown you here. Number one, make sure that the object that you're declaring and that you're animating is being GPU cached. You do that with a cache mode equals bitmap cache attribute. And then let the composition thread do the rest. Now, one thing you should know about the composition thread is that it doesn't even exist in the Silverlight 5 runtime if you don't enable GPU acceleration. So I need to enable GPU acceleration to leverage it. Usually, though, if I'm going to set cache mode equals to bitmap cache, I intend to enable GPU acceleration anyway, because that attribute value pair is basically ignored if I don't separately enable GPU acceleration. So let me show you an example here of the composition thread at work. Now, the composition thread isn't necessarily something that lends itself to demos, but there is an easy way to see it at work. Let me open up this project named Composition Thread Demo to show you what I mean. We're going to run this, and in a moment you're going to see a little partially transparent penguin spinning round and round and round. I originally designed this demo to show the GPU support added to Silverlight back in the days of Silverlight 3. I'm actually stressing the CPU quite a lot here because I've got this gradient background. I've got a partially transparent penguin, which is probably around 500,000 to 1,000,000 pixels. And 60 times a second, I'm rotating him and I'm scaling him, causing the CPU to alpha blend all the pixels in that penguin against that gradient background. In fact, because I am doing this on the CPU at the moment, if I were to pop up Task Manager and look at CPU utilization, I'd probably find out I'm using anywhere from a third to a half of the total CPU available on my laptop just to run this silly little animation. But also, I want you to see this, because right now I'm not using the GPU. I'm doing all of this on the CPU. If I click anywhere in this window, the animation stops for 2 seconds. Why? Because in that very simple click handler that I wrote, I'm calling thread.sleep to put the UI thread to sleep for 2 seconds. How do I know that this is running on the UI thread? Because when the animations stop, that means they're running on the UI thread. Let me do that one more time. Let me click this, and I want you to see that he stops for 2 seconds while I do that thread.sleep. Now, in Silverlight 4, there was no way to work around this. Since the animations were always run on the UI thread there was no way to prevent that animation from pausing, from freezing, when I did something on the UI thread to take the UI thread away from the runtime. In Silverlight 5, thanks to the composition thread, there is. I'm going to go into this app and make a simple change. Specifically, I'm going to go into the HTML test page, and I'm going to change this parameter, enable GPU acceleration, from false to true. So I'm now enabling GPU support in this application. In addition, if you look at mainpage.xaml, where I'm declaring that penguin, which I factored out into a user control, right here, you can see that I've already told the runtime to GPU cache that penguin. So I've taken the 2 steps that are necessary to leverage the composition thread. One, I've enabled GPU acceleration. 2, I've told the runtime which part or parts of the visual tree to bitmap cache, that is, to rasterize once into a 2-dimensional bitmap, then hand off to the GPU. Now, watch what happens when I go back and repeat that same experiment I did a moment ago, where while an animation is running, I call thread.sleep here on the UI thread. You're just going to have to trust me that I actually did click in that window. I'll do it again right here, and here, and here. I'm freezing that UI for 2 seconds at a time, and yet I see no difference in the animations. I see no pausing, no stuttering, no stopping. Why? Because that animation is now being run on the composition thread. Again, it's a trick we borrow from Silverlight for Windows Phone, and it's something that is going to make your applications more responsive than you could possibly have made them in Silverlight 4, particularly when you have animations running. Now, before I go further, I do want to mention something that's very, very important for you to know. The presence of the composition thread in Silverlight 5 does not mean that you, the developer, now have the freedom to enter long-running loops on that UI thread. That's still a no-no, just as it was in Silverlight 4, because there are still lots of things Silverlight 5 does do on the UI thread. In fact, the things that it does do on the UI thread are the rule rather than the exception. If you enter long-running loops, any animation still being run on the UI thread will pause. If you enter long-running loops on the UI thread, Silverlight is still unable to render outside of the GPU. So everything you've learned about threading in Silverlight 4 still applies to Silverlight 5. It's just that with the new composition thread, we've given you some options that you did not have before. So with that, let's go back to the slides for a moment. And I want to talk about some features that are going to be, I believe, incredibly useful to developers, all of them involving data binding. So there are four big new features involving data binding that are coming in Silverlight 5. And rather than describe those right here, I've written a couple of slides for each one, so let me just go straight to those slides. The first one is something that we're calling implicit data templates. Now, data templates, as you probably know, are simply templates that let us tell items controls how to render content that we provide them into XAML. If we take a simple list box, for example, and we data bind it against a collection of CLR instances, CLR object instances, the list box has some basic rendering support built in. If I bind it to an array of strings, for example, it will populate itself with list box items containing the content of those strings. However, if we want to render something a little bit richer than strings, then we invariably end up providing a data template telling that list box or other items control exactly how we want each item that we bind to it rendered into XAML. Here's what implicit data templates do to richen up that story a little bit in Silverlight 5. In Silverlight 4, let's say you're binding a list box or some other control to a collection of items. And let's say that those items are not all of the same type. Maybe you're using a list box control to show a list of audio and video clips. And you've written a couple of classes, one named audio, the other named video, or something like that. Perhaps they even derive from the same base class. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. It doesn't really matter. But you're binding that list box to a collection of audio and video objects. And you would like audio objects to be rendered a little bit differently than video objects. That's what implicit data templates do for you. Look at this little example right here. I've declared two data templates. Notice the lack of an X key attribute. What I'm doing here is I'm assuming that I'm applying these by default, perhaps through a default style to a list box control or perhaps other controls in my XAML. But with the new data type attribute on the data template element, I can specify what type of CLR class instance this data template should be used for. So in this case, I've declared two different data templates which are going to be used with the same list box, one to render out audio objects, another to render out video objects. And, of course, you're not limited to two different types there. You could provide as many as you wanted. Something else that is coming in Silverlight 5 is richer relative source data binding. Now, in the early days of Silverlight data binding, relative source wasn't supported at all. When they finally added in, they gave us support for binding to our templated parent. But Silverlight, unlike WPF, has never been able, through a binding expression, to walk up the visual tree, find an ancestor of the element to which the data binding is applied, and pull a value from that element. That changes in Silverlight 5, where we can use the highlighted syntax you see here. When I write relative source equals relative source ancestor type equals grid, what I'm doing in this example is asking the runtime to assign to the fill property of that ellipse the background property of the grid that is higher up the visual tree. That's why in this example you see that ellipse has been filled with blue. When I'm using that new ancestor type relative source data binding, I can also, if I want, specify an ancestor level. In the second highlighted line here, you can see I've written ancestor level equals 2. I'm asking the runtime to find not the first grid that is the higher in the visual tree than this ellipse, but the second grid. Well, you can see in this example that second grid, the one that is the root in this example, has a background of white. So when I bind that to the fill property of the ellipse, I get an ellipse with a white fill. So if you're a WPF developer, this is probably no great shakes. You've been able to do this in WPF for a long time. Its absence, however, from Silverlight has sometimes tied our hands just a bit, causing us to resort to code rather than XAML to do this kind of thing. With Silverlight 5, the parity between Silverlight XAML and WPF XAML becomes higher. The delta becomes just a little bit lower. Here's something else you can do with data binding in Silverlight 5. In fact, I'm going to use this in the next demo that I do. It's sometimes called style data binding. In Silverlight 4, when you defined a style, you could easily apply that style to objects out there in the XAML DOM. However, we did not support allowing you to use data binding to assign values to style setters. That changes in version 5, where you can use a syntax like I'm doing here. Notice I've declared a simple style named, actually I haven't given a name. That means it's a default style. It's going to be applied by default, in this case to text block elements. But notice in the setter for the foreground property, instead of hard coding a value there, I'm using a data binding expression to get that value. Now, why is this important? Why might this make your life a little bit easier as a Silverlight developer? Well, among other things, this makes it easier than it has ever been to do dynamic theming of your applications in Silverlight, and it is that dynamic theming that I'm going to demonstrate for you in just a moment. It's not the only way to do dynamic theming in Silverlight, but it is arguably the best way to do it in the era of Silverlight 5. Another feature related to data binding that developers are going to enjoy, I believe, is the ability to debug data binding expressions. Now, people are already writing about this, and sometimes they're referring to this as XAML debugging. And it is XAML debugging, sort of. When I demo this for you, you're going to see that now I can put a breakpoint in XAML, which I've never been able to do before. However, I like to call this data binding debugging or simply binding debugging because I don't want you to go away from here thinking that you can put a breakpoint on any statement in XAML. You cannot. What you can do is put a breakpoint on XAML statements that have binding expressions. Now, if there's something wrong with that expression, if you want to find out how often the expression is being evaluated, if you want to see the data moving back and forth each time it's evaluated, you can do that right there in the Visual Studio debugger rather than have to write your own instrumentation, for example, custom value converters to do it. This could be, folks, the feature that developers like the most in Silverlight 5. Let me show you what I mean. I first want to demonstrate style data binding to you. So I'm going to open a project named, naturally enough, Style Data Binding Demo. Notice how I've cleverly named these so you'll never figure out what they actually do. And when we run it, we're going to see a little XAML UI come up. And I'm going to use this to demonstrate dynamic theming. In fact, each time I click in the browser window, you'll see the theme change. We change from that darkish bluish theme to a lightish orangish theme. If I click again, it reverts to the original theme, and I can just keep clicking and clicking and clicking forever. Now, you could do this in Silverlight 4, but the way you would do it is very different from the way that I've done it here in Silverlight 5. So let's take a look here at what makes this application tick. How do you do dynamic theming in Silverlight 5? It begins with a little class I wrote named ColorTheme. This is the class that's going to store all the information about the theme colors. In fact, it exposes properties with names like background color, accent color, background brush that I can use to set colors on layout controls and other things, text blocks in Silverlight. It also implements the iNotify property changed interface. That's a pretty clear indication that I'm going to use this as the data source in a data binding scenario. As you may already know, implementing iNotify property changed allows a binding object to know in real time when a property value in a data source has changed so that it can propagate that changed value from the data source to the data target. So after writing the color theme property, I went over to app.xaml and I defined some styles. Here's what those styles look like. So here's a style, for example, named normal text, one named accent text, another named background gradient, which not surprisingly I'm using to produce that background gradient that you saw in the application. But what's interesting about this and what's unique about it to Silverlight 5 is that I've used binding expressions right here in the property setters to refer to properties with names like TextBrush in a source named Theme. Well, what is Theme? Theme is simply a local instance of that color theme class I showed you a moment ago that I've declared right here in app.xaml. So I now have this color theme instance that's containing all the colors for the theme that is currently shown. I have styles that use binding expressions to depend on that color theme instance. And in mainpage.xaml, not surprisingly, I've assigned those styles that you saw there in app.xaml to various XAML elements in the scene. Here, for example, I've assigned this text block the style normal text. Here I've assigned this text block the style accent text. When I clicked in the browser window and you saw the theme colors change, here's what was going on. Let's take a quick look inside mainpage.xaml.cs. There, I have a simple mouse left button down handler. Each time that handler fires, I reach over into my global resources right here, find the one named theme, cast it to a color theme object, and call a public method on it named toggleColors. Well, what does that toggleColors method do? That was a public method I built into the color theme class. It's there that it changes its own property values to reflect a particular theme. Again, not the only way to do it, and I'm not trying to tell you that you couldn't do dynamic theming in Silverlight 4, you could. But with style data binding, you now have a new way to do it. Now, while we're at it, let's take a look at data binding debugging, also known as XAML debugging. One of the most frustrating things developers ever run into in Silverlight is when there's some type of syntactical error in a binding expression. In fact, we're going to introduce a syntactical error here. Let's go back into mainpage.xaml, and let's do something like this. Let's misspell one of these style names. Instead of normal text, it's normal text. It's even hard to pronounce. When I run this thing, well, we're actually going to get an error message there that we wouldn't have gotten in Silverlight 4. Instead of misspelling that, what I'd like to do instead is this. In fact, let me go into a completely separate project. I'm going to go back to one of the ones that we looked at a little bit earlier. In fact, we'll go to the first one. This will allow me to better demonstrate this because I don't want to see any error messages. So, this was the one showing the rich text box overflow control and the flow of text from one to the other. You may recall that I had a pair of sliders at the bottom of the page that I could use to do things like vary the font size. Let me show you real quickly what that binding looks like. Here is the first of those two slider controls. And if you look inside the rich text box control right here, we should find the binding expression that binds it to that slider. Here we are. Here, the font size property of that rich text box is coming from the value property of the XAML element named font size slider, which was the slider that I just showed you. Now, let's introduce some kind of error here. Maybe we just called it val rather than value. Now, when we run it, at least I think, we're not going to see any kind of error message. Indeed. What we will find, however, though, is that moving that slider thumb does absolutely nothing. And this is that frustrating situation I was telling you about a moment ago. Wouldn't it be nice if the runtime gave us some indication that we had a typo in that binding expression? Well, take a look at this. When I run this and I see that the data binding I attempted to create apparently wasn't working, I can now do this. I'm going to put a breakpoint right here in the XAML. And I'm going to press F5 to run this thing, and we're going to see Visual Studio break in and show us that binding at work. So there it is. You can see that I've hit a breakpoint in XAML. And now, let's see here. I want to see. Let's go to. My configuration has changed since I ran this a little bit earlier. Let's see, let's go to debug and see what I wanted to show me some other stuff. Actually, window, I guess. Nope, I'm wanting to see locals. view, 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 view. View, view. Yes, yes. Let's see here. Other windows. Let's see, locals. Although, huh. So help me out here. Where am I missing this? Where do I get the locals? Ah, yes, 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 yes. There we go. Let's see if locals will give me what I want. Yes, thank you. We're doing some extreme programming here, aren't we? So you can see this binding state object. Take a look inside here, folks. And unfortunately, it's not working. Wait a minute. No, it is, because I have multiple bindings in there. Let's try doing an F5 again to see if I can land on the next binding statement. Nope, it went right back to it. So let me go back and refresh the browser window. In fact, let's try this. I haven't run this at 1024 by 768. Maybe the problem is, I'm going to do an F5 again. Maybe I need to put this down here. Oh, look at that. Sure enough. Now, let's go back and refresh that browser window and see if we can hit that breakpoint and see what's going on with our binding. Ah, yes. Do you see this right here? Now, under locals, binding state shows me error, system.exception. And if we look at that, it says val property not found on system.windowsControls.slider. So now, instead of having to guess as to why that binding isn't working, it's out there in front of us. The runtime, well, actually Visual Studio, is telling us that it can't find that property. And based on that, it becomes easier for me to fix it. Instead of typing val, I should have typed value. Now I'll bet when I run the thing, it works the same way that it did before. In fact, there you go. So that is XAML debugging, or so-called data binding debugging, and it allows us to put breakpoints on binding expressions in XAML. There's no support for putting breakpoints on anything else in XAML, but that could change in the future. For today, we can put breakpoints on those binding expressions in XAML. That's helpful not only for diagnosing errors, by the way, but also for seeing when the binding is being evaluated, when the data is moving back and forth, what the value of the data moving back and forth is. In the past, we had to write value converters to plug in to see what was happening and when. Now, we don't have to do that anymore. So, back to PowerPoint one more time. Something else that's new and exciting in version 5, custom markup extensions. Again, something that has been supported in WPF for a long time, but is just now coming to Silverlight. This was one of the features that was most requested by developers who are using Silverlight. What is a custom markup extension? Simply put, it allows us to extend the XAML language by writing extensions to it ourselves. Now, WPF has always supported a fairly rich variety of markup extensions, static resource, dynamic resource, and a whole bunch of others. Silverlight, since version 2, has supported a subset of those markup extensions, but it has never, unlike WPF, supported custom markup extensions. Now we can write custom markup extensions, and we can use them to do all sorts of interesting things. I think that this is going to be another one of those top three or four features that developers find incredibly useful when they are once they learn about it and start finding ways to leverage it. Here is one example of why custom markup extensions can be so exciting. If you work on teams that do Silverlight development, you might be doing MVVM development. Why do we like MVVM development? Because it gives us greater separation of concerns in a team environment. It allows us more easily to compartmentalize different parts of the app so different parts of the team can work and test on those parts independently. But if you have been involved in an MVVM project, you're probably aware that because there is not full commanding support in Silverlight, we have to bring in third-party tools to add that commanding support. While Silverlight 4, for example, does put a command property on button that allows you to bind a command exported by a view model to a button, Silverlight 4 doesn't do anything like that on, say, a list box control. Well, in Silverlight 5, what we can do is this. We can write a custom markup extension. We may call it method invoke. We could call it anything we liked. And then we could use it to generically bind any event fired by a control to a method in our view model that we want to be called when that event is fired. In fact, that example of a custom markup extension is already available as a Silverlight 5 sample. And what I've basically done in this slide right here is used that sample markup extension to show what an MVVM view might look like if we're using it. Now, you may wonder, how do I write a custom markup extension? Well, fundamentally, it's pretty simple. You derive a class of your own from a new base class in Silverlight 5 named markup extension. Typically, you'll give this derived class a name that ends with extension, although that is not technically required when you get right down to it. Then, in that derived class, you build in public properties, one for each named parameter you want the markup extension to support. In this very simple example right here, I'm implementing a property named text. Then you override the one method that you inherit from the markup extension base class. That method is named provideValue. And your job in that method is to take that custom markup extension and to return to the XAML parser whatever value you want it to evaluate to. In this very simple example here, what I'm returning is some text. The content of the text is the word hello, followed by the value of the text property. Now, as simple as this markup extension is, it actually does work. In fact, I can do something like this. I declare a text block in XAML, and then I use this custom markup extension to initialize its text property. Its text property. And in the text parameter of the markup extension, I pass in some text. What I get back in this case is hello Silverlight 5. Now, markup extensions in real life will often be more complex than that, but they won't necessarily be more complex. You may have wondered, by the way, if you go back a slide, you'll notice that the provide value override in your derived class receives a reference to something called iService provider. Well, what is that? Here's what you can do. iService provider has one method. That method is named getService. And what it allows you to do, if you need it in your markup extension, is to reach out to the Silverlight runtime to get help doing the things that markup extensions sometimes need to do. For example, if you were writing your own custom version of the built-in binding extension in Silverlight, one of the things you'd need to be able to do in your provide value method is get more information about the object that is the data target. You may want to know what type of object it is, what property you're assigning a value to, what type that property is, even what the name of the property is. You can get that from the Silverlight runtime by in provide value calling that getService method and asking for an iProvide value target interface. Or if you were building your own custom version of the binding markup extension and you wanted to support an element name attribute just like the binding markup extension does, you're going to have a way inside your provide value method to take an element name that has been declared in XAML and to resolve that into a reference to a type instance. That's what the iXAML type resolver interface is for. And there is one other interface supported in Silverlight 5 when you call getService. That is iRoot object provider. If you need to know in your markup extension which XAML element sits at the top of the visual tree, you can request that interface through getService, make a simple call on it, and get that information. Simple example of how you might use this. Here inside a provide value method, I want to know a little bit more about the property whose value is being assigned by my custom markup extension. So I do this. I call iService provider getService, asking for a runtime implemented iProvide value target interface. Then I work with it to find out what type of property I'm assigning a value to and what the name of that property is. Let me show you an example here of these custom markup extensions at work. Whoops, went one too far, so we'll back up just a bit. So I want to open up another project, this one named Custom Markup Extension Demo. And I built this because I think that this is one scenario in which developers like you and I are going to find custom markup extensions useful. I'm using it here to do localization. Probably more interesting to you than me. You know how it is in the U.S. We just assume everyone in the world speaks English. Over here, you folks have to deal with the reality of that not everyone in the world speaks English. So in this example here, you see some localized content. You see the word welcome in English, and you see a U.S. flag. But I'm going to go into app.xaml.cs real quickly, and we're going to change that. I'm going to uncomment a line of code that creates a culture info object representing the French culture, and I'm going to assign that culture info object to the current thread via its current culture and current UI culture properties. And what I would expect to see when I restart this thing is content that has been localized for French. That's about the extent of my bilingualness, by the way. And I hope bienvenue means welcome in French. If it doesn't, don't tell me, okay? At least not until after the session's over. So let me show you how this works. Now, I'll bet a lot of you in this room have done localization in XAML before. And if so, you've probably found that it's just a little bit clunky, because what we normally do if we're doing resex-based localization in XAML is we use data binding to assign values to XAML elements. Specifically, we will create an instance of the resource manager wrapper class that Visual Studio generates, then we will data bind to properties in that class. Well, I'm doing effectively the same thing here, but I'm not using any data binding whatsoever. Instead, I'm using a custom markup extension. Take a look at this right here. For that welcome message that you saw at the top, the text property of that text block is coming from something called resex. This is an instance of a class I've written named resex extension. Notice that even if I do include extension in my class name, the XAML parser does not require me to enter that. So the class is named resex extension, but in XAML, I leverage it simply by writing resex. In this custom markup extension, I've built in properties named resex key, resex type, and I even have something called default, which allows someone using this markup extension to provide a default value that will be used if for some reason this value cannot be retrieved from a resex. Now, these two properties, resex key and resex type, this is simply the property in the Visual Studio generated resource manager wrapper class that corresponds to this localization resource. Resex type actually identifies the Visual Studio generated resex wrapper class. In this case, it's an instance of a class named resources. Because I named my resex files or gave them the root name resources, the resource manager wrapper that Visual Studio generates is named resources as well. That's the class I'm referring to right here. So instead of using data binding to do localization, I clean up the syntax a bit with my own custom markup extension named resex extension. If you care to see what the source code for it looks like, you can see it in the file named resexextension.cs. There's really not that much there to it. You can see I've implemented three public properties. Remember, these define the named parameters that you can someone using your markup extension can use in their XAML. And I've overridden the provide value method that's inherited from markup extension. And you can see that my provide value method is relatively simple. I use reflection to go in and create an instance of the type that's identified in the resex type parameter. Remember, that type name is the name of the Visual Studio generated resources wrapper class. Then I use the resex key property, also in the markup extension, to identify a property, and I go grab that from the resource manager wrapper that I just created through reflection. A lot of bang for the buck here, because it doesn't take a whole lot of code to get this done. If there are other needs that you have in your localization that you can't get through data binding expressions, you could easily take what I've done here and embellish it so that you could do even more. This, I think, is going to be a very, very popular feature, the ability to extend the XAML language by writing custom markup extensions. But that's not all, because there is more in Silverlight 5. One of the big things that I haven't mentioned yet is improvements to trusted applications. Most of these improvements came as a direct result of feedback from the community who said, we really, really, really need this in Silverlight 5. For example, in Silverlight 4, trusted applications had to be out of browser apps. They weren't allowed to run inside the browser. Silverlight 5 allows trusted applications to run inside the browser, folks, and that's a good thing. In Silverlight 4, an untrusted application could use a web browser control, but only an out-of-browser app could use a web browser control. Short story there was that in Silverlight 4, we could not use a web browser control to show HTML content inside an in-browser application. That also changes in Silverlight 5. Not only are we allowing trusted applications to run in the browser, we allow web browser controls showing HTML and perhaps script content in the browser as well. Another feature that came as a direct result of feedback was the ability to create multiple window Silverlight applications. I'm going to demo these for you here in just a moment. You can now, if you're an out-of-browser app and if you're trusted, you can create additional windows, and you can even message back and forth between those windows. Something else, this was a fairly late decision made as the team was beginning to work on Silverlight 5, but it's one that I think a lot of us will welcome. In Silverlight 4, a trusted application could access the file system without popping up an open file or save file dialog, but it was restricted in which parts of the file system it could access. It could only access the so-called my folders, my videos, my pictures, my documents, etc. In case you didn't know this already, I think you're going to be glad to know that in Silverlight 5, a trusted application can access any part of the file system without restriction. Meaning, if you now want to go out and create temporary files, you can do that. In fact, anything that you can do in a normal non-Silverlight application with a file system, you can now do with a trusted application in Silverlight 5. So let's talk about these three features in just a bit more detail. So I told you that you can now run trusted applications inside the browser, and that is true. There are some permissions that have to be set up before that can happen. These permissions involve the certification store on the client machine and the registry on the client machine. Microsoft's thinking here is not that we want users tweaking registry keys, but that we want system administrators tweaking registry keys through policies. But in order for a user to run a trusted application in browser, there are a couple of requirements that have to be met. Number one, there is a key that has to be added to the registry on that machine. The path differs somewhat based on whether it's 32-bit Windows or 64-bit Windows. That's why I'm showing two paths right here. In addition, the ZAP that houses that trusted application must be signed, and the certificate used to sign it has to be in the trusted publisher's certificate store on the user's machine. Now, again, you may look at this and think, wait a minute, this is a lot of trouble to go to. I don't want to force my users to do this. But once more, the idea isn't that the user makes these configuration changes to allow trusted apps in browser, but that a system administrator does. One thing you'll probably be glad to know as a developer is that these requirements are waived for localhost. So when you're running and testing your application by downloading from localhost, you can run trusted apps in browser even if the registry hasn't been set up to allow that, even if the ZAP isn't signed, and if it has been signed, even if that certificate doesn't appear in your trusted publisher's certificate store. Now, quickly here, I'm showing at the top what you have to do in the registry to allow your users to run trusted apps in browser. You can see that new allow elevated trust apps in browser registry key added in. The window on the bottom half of this slide is showing the certificate store on my machine. Specifically, I'm looking in the trusted publisher's certificate store, and I find there the certificate that was used to sign the ZAP housing this application. Unless the application comes from localhost, these two requirements must be met on that client machine in order for a trusted application to run in browser. And although this isn't documented very well, there's actually more that you can do here. What if you found yourself in a situation where you have a trusted application, you want your users to be able to run it in browser, But you don't want users to be able to install trusted applications on their machine. In other words, you're fine with having them run it in browser, but you do not want them to be able to install it as an out-of-browser application on that machine. There is a separate registry key that you can use to make that happen. It is the allow install of elevated apps elevated trust apps registry key. If you add it, and if you set it to zero, as I've done here, the user will only be able to run that trusted application, or any trusted application for that matter, in their browser. They will not be able to locally install those trusted applications. And it's interesting, although this is not documented, if you don't have that key in the registry, Silverlight interprets that as meaning that you do want to allow the installation of trusted apps. So in order to allow these trusted apps to run in browser, but to prevent them from being installed and run outside the browser, you have to add this key to the registry. I mentioned a moment ago that there are no longer any limits on file system access as performed by trusted applications. That is true. In this simple example here, I do something that there was no possible way to do in Silverlight 4, short of getting out of the sandbox by writing a COM automation class that would give you direct access to the file system. Look what I'm doing. I'm enumerating the files in the system32 directory and then showing those to the user in a list box. I don't know if there's ever any reason you would need to do exactly that, but it still makes me feel warm all over looking at this code, just knowing that I can do it now. And one other thing that trusted applications can do, they can now create other windows. Not child windows, which Silverlight has supported for a while, which are really pseudo windows that can't be dragged outside the browser, but real operating system windows. How do we do that? By doing exactly what I'm doing here. I new up a window object, as you see here. I configure it, telling it how wide and tall I want it to be, where I want it to appear on the screen, what I want to appear in its title bar. And then ultimately, I set its visibility property to visible to make it visible to the user. How do I control what's shown inside that window? Through XAML. What I'm doing here is I've created a user control, which I call pop-up window user control, which contains all of the content in XAML that I want to appear in this pop-up window. I new up an instance of that user control and simply assign it to the window's content property. The user now sees that window. I'll demo that for you in a moment. There's even a new API that allows an application to enumerate the windows that it has created. Here, using the new windows property added to the application class in Silverlight 5, I'm iterating over those, determining which of those are other windows and which one is my main window. Maybe I want to do something, fire off a message to each one of them. This allows me to do that without having prior knowledge of what windows may be visible to the user. Let me show you a simple example showing how that works. So here is a two-window Silverlight application. It's a trusted out-of-browser application. By the way, in-browser apps are not allowed to display additional windows. Only out-of-browser apps can do that. And yes, the out-of-browser app has to be a trusted application in order to have permission to create multiple windows. Now, there is the other window that I created. I created that when this one started up. I'm showing some thumbnail images in that other window. And each time I click one of the thumbnail images inside that other window, I fire a message off to the main window so that it can update its content accordingly. Again, no reasonable way to do that in Silverlight 4, but relatively easy in version 3. Now, we only have 3 minutes left, so I'm not going to go through the code. It's very much like what you saw on the slide. I do, however, want to close out by talking just a little bit about 3D in Silverlight 5. Arguably, the biggest and most important new feature of Silverlight 5 is a full-blown three-dimensional graphics engine. In fact, it's kind of interesting. The Silverlight team chose not to use the WPF 3D API, but instead to use the XNA 3D API. So you can now build XNA apps for Xbox, you can build XNA apps for Windows phones, and you can build XNA graphics applications for Silverlight as well. Now, I've got several slides in here showing the basics of 3D. One of the things you have to do in order to use it, for example, is enable GPU acceleration in your app. All of this rendering done in for 3D applications is done on the GPU. We don't even support software rendering there. I'm going to show you an example, and you're going to find out that there's a new control or new type in XAML called drawing surface. To do 3D in an app, you begin by declaring a drawing surface control. In fact, your entire app doesn't have to be 3D. You could have a normal Silverlight application with some 3D content in it simply by declaring a drawing surface control and restricting it to what part of the Silverlight control you wanted that drawing surface to consume. Drawing surface fires draw events. And guess what? It fires them on the composition thread, not the UI thread. It is in those draw events that you use XNA's 3D API to draw whatever you want to draw in 3D. It is an immediate mode API. It's fairly low level. It's not complete in the Silverlight 5 beta, but there is enough there already that you can at least get an idea of what's possible and what's not and find out how performant it's going to be. Here's one of my favorite examples. It's one of the few great examples that are available already. This was published a week or so ago. In fact, the source code was just published last week. If you were at Mix in Las Vegas a few days ago or watched the keynote online, you may remember this demo. There are 76,000 active polygons in this scene. I can use the arrow keys to walk around. I can use the mouse to turn around. Oh, in fact, there's something right there. Does anyone recognize this person right there? That is our fearless leader, Mr. Scott Guthrie. You can't build a 3D demo at Microsoft without having his shining face in there. So it looks like I'm going to have to move over just a little bit. Now we'll get up there and we'll turn around and get a really good look at Scott there. Let's see if I can do that. And we'll even back up. So that is 3D, all GPU accelerated. Full source code is available. What you'll find if you look at the source code and also the source code for one 3D sample that I included in the zip file that goes with this session, you'll find that most of the work involves creating the scene that you're drawing. What you're doing is creating a polygonal mesh, lots and lots and lots of little triangles. You're handing those off to the rendering engine in each call to draw and just asking it to draw for you, doing the shading, lighting, the culling of back surfaces and things like that. Last thing here I want to mention before we close out is this. There are a few features in the Silverlight 5 beta that I haven't mentioned. I've listed some of those right here. One of the ones that may impact you is a new click count property in the mouse button event args. If you want to respond to double clicks or triple clicks, for example, rather than single clicks, you can now check the click count property. If it's equal to 2, that means that a double click just occurred. There are also several features that aren't in the beta but that have been promised to us. You may know, for example, that in Silverlight 4, which was the first version to acquire printing support, the printing is very, very slow because all Silverlight 4 is doing when it prints a page is it's rasterizing into pixels everything that you hand to it. In Silverlight 5, they're adding PostScript vector printing support, so printing in most cases will be much, much faster. If you print something you've declared in XAML, a bunch of vector objects, they will go out to the printer as vectors too, rather than as rasterized bitmaps. One last thing here, maybe the most eagerly anticipated feature of Silverlight 5 is not present in the beta. That is the ability to p-invoke, the ability for native applications to p-invoke and invoke operating system functions in Windows, allowing them to completely escape the sandbox. It's not there in the beta. That doesn't mean Microsoft has forgotten about it. It will be there before Silverlight 5 ships, as well as some other things you see listed right here. And with that, we are out of time. In fact, more than out of time, so I'm going to stop right there. After I tear down, I'm going to hang around some outside here. If you have any questions, I would love to take those for you. Thanks for attending the session. Hope it was useful.